Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 1st, 2003. Today's session is entitled An Ethic of Community Service, Session 5 of Healing the World, Ideas, Perspectives from Luther and the Lutheran Tradition, presented by Daryl Jodoc, number JOD 2003-05. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming. Bob, this is a signal to start the tape. Or the CD.
I'm Daryl Jodoc, and I teach at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota.
And the theme for the week has been Healing the World, Ideas and Perspectives from Luther and the Lutheran Tradition. And today the topic is to talk about an ethic of community service. So my pattern has been to say a few, make an introductory presentation, and then have some chance for conversation and dialogue. And particularly on this one, I'm going to invite you to think, to amplify, expand, and add to whatever it is that I say. Because when we're talking about the field of ethics in about 30 minutes, all I can do is introduce the topic and not get into a lot of detail. So let me begin by saying that there are two things in Luther that are important to keep in mind as background for this discussion. The first of these two things is a sense of humor that Luther had. And I mean that on about three different levels. The first level of sense of humor is simply that he liked to crack jokes and not take himself too seriously. You always had some witty remark about something or another. When he was once given credit for starting the Reformation and praised for doing that, he responded, "I didn't do a thing. All I did was let the Word of God loose, and while my friend Philip and I sat drinking good Wittenberg beer, the Word of God did it all." Don't take that too seriously. He would kid around with his wife Katie, send her letters with all sorts of honorific titles, Countess of Zulsdorf, which was the house that they lived in, mistress of the pig market, because she was always in charge of all of the animals as well as the household help and so on, and whatsoever other titles befit her eminence and so on. He was almost drowned the last trip of his life where he died, when he was crossing a river that was flooding, and he kidded about it being a monstrous Anabaptist rising up to immerse him, like you would in that kind of baptism. So on one level, there simply was a sense of humor, which in and of itself is significant if one believes Fred Meuser. Fred Meuser, who used to be the president of Trinity Seminary and was vice president of the ALC and on the commission that formed the ELCA, told the audience one time, we sat during the merger negotiations for the ELC, and Norwegians would tell stories about Swedes and everybody would laugh, and Swedes would tell stories about Norwegians and everybody would laugh, and there we sat, Germans. That's no laughing matter. So Luther was an exception to whatever that stereotype might be about Germans. So on one level, there's simply that sense of humor, which is remarkable. And it's a sense of humor that certainly did not get in the way of commitment, of deep commitment, because he could argue just as vigorously as possible, and in the tradition of the day, call people names as they were calling him names and so on in print, and engage in the most serious kinds of arguments, stand up before the emperor and all the princes of the Holy Roman Empire and say he would not recant. I mean, there was serious commitment there. At the same time, there was sense of humor. I think the second level in which the sense of humor operates is that for Lutheran theology, if God justifies us without any merit on our part, then we ought not to take anything too seriously. Okay? We'll take things seriously, but not too seriously. We shouldn't take ourselves too seriously if we're not justified because we're particularly good. We shouldn't take our ethical accomplishments.
accomplishments and our virtues too seriously. We shouldn't even take our theology too seriously. For Luther, for example, there was nothing much more important to him than the Bible. He taught it, he prized it, he read it, he memorized it, he recommended it. It was the source of all sorts of things. And yet, he still had a sense of humor about this. And he would joke about throwing the Epistle of James out and taking all of Melanchthon's writings as associates, put it into the Bible, that you could joke about the things most sacred to himself. And so there's a sense in which the theological tradition is not to take things too seriously. Also, the third level on which one could talk is the freedom to risk either making a mistake ethically or to risk doing something which impugns one's own reputation. When he was writing a letter to his overly cautious colleague Melanchthon, he told him to just act. I mean, don't sit around thinking about it all the time. Just decide on something and do it. And even if it means sin boldly and love Christ more boldly still. Now, that's not a general recommendation to everybody, but it was a recommendation to a very cautious colleague that he knew very well and had a lot of respect for. So one of the things I think to remember when we're talking about ethical behavior is that it should be sort of surrounded by a sense of humor, in the sense of taking things seriously, but not too seriously. There's a kind of grim moralism that we should not get ourselves into, even though we take it seriously. Coupled with that, as it is in Luther, often things are in tension with each other, is the evidences in his thinking of quite a radical ethic. That is, Luther expected of Christians something quite different from what the normal discussion occurs in our society of rights. For Christians, Christians were not about defending their own rights, as far as Luther is concerned. They might be about defending the dignity of somebody else, but they were to put up with almost anything coming their way. As far as he has some very, very vivid kinds of statements about this. He would also expect that Christians would serve others with a kind of radicality that meant a kind of self-forgetfulness, with a kind of radicality that meant that one was prepared for it to be costly in some way or another to oneself. In his own case, his own sense of vocation as a teacher of the church meant that he needed to go ahead and speak out, even if it meant, as he expected, that he would be martyred. You remember that when he got married, that story, he had gotten some of the nuns had come out of the convent and come to Wittenberg, and in those days, there was nothing else to do with somebody that was a single person except to find a spouse. And so he'd set to work to find a spouse for Katie. And the first one didn't work out because his parents wouldn't allow him to marry an ex-nun. And the second one was somebody that she couldn't abide. And so she told one of Luther's colleagues that she would rather marry X, Y, or even Luther himself rather than this man. And Luther thought this was really funny, and he went home to his father and said, "Ha ha, you never believe what happened." And he's 46 years old now, right? And you never believe what happened. Somebody said, "They'd even want to marry me." And his father said, "That's not such a silly idea. Why don't you do it?" And so he wound up getting married for three reasons: to please his father, to spite the Pope, and to seal his witness to his faith before his martyrdom. Just like he said, if he knew the world would end, he'd plant a tree. So facing martyrdom to get married seemed to him to be an expression of faith. Nothing about love in there, no. But then after marriage, he felt deeply head over heels in love with Katie. So it was quite a marvelous marriage. But you know, she put up with a lot for him. But at any rate, there was a radicality of commitment that he expected of Christians. that was significant. So on the one hand, you have a sense of humor. On the other hand, you have this radicality of ethics going on at the end of the third. Now, if one wants to talk about the ethical principle, as I said earlier this week in another class, another session, that's rather simple on one hand and complex on another. It's simple in the sense that the ethical principle is whatever action benefits one's neighbor or the community is good. Whatever action harms or doesn't benefit one's neighbor or the community is not good. Pretty simple. But not always easy to put into practice. My advisor, when I was in graduate school, talked about the limitations of the golden rule. He said, for example, it took us, that is him and his wife, a long time to discover that they had very different wants when either of them was ill. He wanted to be pampered when he was sick, and she wanted to be left alone when she was sick. So he, employing the golden rule, would try to pamper her and not understand the reaction that he got. And she, trying to embody the golden rule, would ignore him and not understand the reaction he got, right? It wasn't easy to put this golden rule into practice if the expectations were different. And so it's very, very important to listen intensively in order to figure out what it is that genuinely does benefit or what does harm our neighbor or the community. And the more complex, the more people are involved, the more complex it gets. I mean, it's one thing to listen to one person in a marriage, that's difficult enough to do well. But when one gets into larger and larger communities, it gets to be more and more complex to figure out what genuinely does benefit the community. One of my friends spent a year in Wainwright, Alaska, which is a village of 600 people, and he was telling about the fact that the Native Americans in Wainwright, there were two non-Native Americans there the winter he was there, himself and one other person, all other 600 were Native Americans, were Eskimos, I forget the...
Alaskan Natives.
Yeah, but...
Inuit.
Yeah, I think it's Inuit. Yeah, that was the word I couldn't remember. And of course, because of the pipeline going across Alaska, there's a certain compensation that goes to all the tribes. And some very well-meaning, very well-intentioned person, this illustrates that good intentions are not enough. Okay? Good intentions are important, but they're not sufficient. Decided that it seemed strange that the checks were going to the, quote, rich people in Wainwright. So this very well-intentioned person, somewhere in the bureaucracy, decided to send the checks to the poor people in Wainwright. Well, the rich people in Wainwright were the people with pickup trucks. And what happened every time the rich people got that check was that they used the check to buy gas, to go hunt caribou with their pickup truck, and bring back meat to the village that was used by the whole village all year. When the poor people got, quote, poor people, got the checks, the internal traditions of the tribe were such that it wasn't, you know, possible to give it over to the rich people. So no pickup trucks went, no caribou was hunted, and the whole village was without protein for the entire year as a result. Well-intentioned, but not having understood enough for the action to wind up to actually be benefiting, it actually harmed the village to do that. So the larger it gets and the more diverse we get, the more cultural differences there are, the more difficult it is to figure out what needs to be done. And, you know, we could take lots of examples. Is it better to restrict carbon emissions for people in third world, or is it better to permit development so that there can be jobs? I mean, these are not easy things to sort out. Just the fact that the principle is simple doesn't necessarily mean that the application is easy. And this is one reason why we need each other to sort these things through. We need communities and moral deliberation. We need chances for education, all of those things to help us learn and not to listen intensively to be able to make good decisions. Let me try to add a half a dozen suggestions that are kind of moving in the direction of advice as ways to apply this. And the first of these little kind of recommendations is to remember our human embeddedness and connectedness, that we are embedded in a society and in a world where every one of our actions has some impact on somebody else or on the creation. And so we need to think carefully about the consequences of those actions and to explore what the consequences might be. I mentioned earlier this week, if you were in the Holocaust and you were a person driving a train, and you sensed your vocation was just to do a good job of being an engineer, you could contribute to a Holocaust by driving the trains and carrying the cargo if you didn't ask other questions about who were these people and where were they going and what was their destination once they got there, etc. Similarly, one could do nothing and contribute to a Holocaust. Right? So even doing nothing is an action for which we have to think about the consequences. It's interesting, by the way, that contrary to some popular attention, public protest matters even in a totalitarian society. The example that we can cite is that in 1941, the Nazis started a euthanasia campaign where they'd take somebody that was mentally ill, shift them to another hospital, and by the time they got far enough away from relatives and home community, then do put them to death. And it was Bishop Gallen who led a protest against this. And the protest was significant enough, so they had first stopped the program, right, in 1941, even in wartime situation. So, doing nothing was a way of contributing to whatever it was that was happening at that particular time. So we need to remember our embeddedness and our connectedness when it comes to our impact on the natural environment, when it comes to our impact on each other, when it comes to our impact on people far away from us, in terms of what we work or what we buy or what we don't buy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the second of these principles that I'd like to suggest is to recognize our creatureliness. It seems to me that we could summarize the Christian faith by saying we are called to be creatures. Now, we're creatures in the sense of acknowledging that we're not God, and that God is God. That's part of being a creature. And being a creature, therefore, is acknowledging limits and recognizing limits. But being a creature is also being endowed with freedom and responsibility. That is, being a human-type creature, at least, being involved with freedom and responsibility. And the kind of responsibility that, during this week, I've been calling co-creator, being responsible for the world, along with God's responsibility for the world and for human beings. So we would violate the sense of limits if we were to think that humans could fix anything in the environment. Now, what I mean by that is it comes from a statement that's made by Jeffrey Beekers. He says at one point, when it came time to stop the flooding on the Thames, the humans could control the river by building dams. When it came time to end the pollution of the Thames, humans could do it only by limiting themselves. So that we can contribute to the ecology of the world by limiting the damage that we do, but we cannot expect our technology to be able to necessarily repair that damage. We can't expect, for example, that we can rebuild an ancient forest. We can't expect that we can find some way to replenish the supply of petroleum once it's been exhausted in the world. We can't expect that we can figure out some way to get the silt out of the Gulf of Mexico and spread on the fields of the Mississippi River Basin from which it has eroded. I mean, our role is to limit erosion, not to simply blithely anticipate that somebody, somehow, somewhere, will find some solution to this and be able to reverse the damage that's been done. Okay. So our sense of limits as creatures means that we can't behave sort of wantonly like gods or whatever, expecting that we also can figure out a way to clean up the damage afterwards. The sense of responsibility and freedom is, we ignore that, if we say we can't do anything about it. If we say we have no, there's nothing, no difference that we can make. If we become completely passive, that's to opt out of our creaturely sense of freedom and responsibility. And that would be to violate that side of it. So to recognize creatureliness, I'm suggesting, is part of a principle that we could use. If we were to expect God to take care of everything, that's also a violation of creatureliness. That is, prayer is very, very important, but prayer is a self-involving thing, and prayer is not a substitute for action. It is a way to focus action. Right? So we shouldn't expect God to pick up the pieces either. That's also a violation of our creatureliness, it seems to me. The third one is to pay attention to poor, oppressed, disadvantaged. You can extend that list out. Luther, in his commentary on the Magnificat I mentioned earlier, that section in Luke 1 where Mary is talking about her God having chosen her to be the mother of Jesus, Luther comments extensively about God's feeding the hungry, lifting up the poor, breaking down the powerful, sending the rich away empty-handed. There is this kind of leveling action that God is doing behind the scenes. And so it seems to me that if we were to recognize God active in the world, as Luther would say, the invitation that we have is an invitation to be with God in terms of the attention given to the poor and oppressed and so on. There's a special responsibility that comes there, and that has to be factored in to everything. I've been reading Nickel and Dimed this week. I'm only halfway through it. I'm Not Getting By in America. And it's a very, very vivid reminder of working poor in our society and the plight of working poor. Someone calculated, this is not in that book, but I read another article where someone calculated that if you worked at Walmart and you were to try to buy your necessities at Walmart, you wouldn't have enough wages from Walmart to be able to buy at Walmart what you needed to live in terms of food and clothing and so on. So there's a really real problem with working poor in our society. And John Marty talked about the way in which they have no effective voice in the legislature. So one of the things that Christians are called upon to do is to be the voice of the voiceless, to lend their political clout to somebody that does not have political clout. And of course, in order to be the voice of the voiceless, we have to listen, 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 to understand so that we can represent with authenticity what the real problems of people are rather than our presumed problems of what they might have or whatever. Now, it seems to me that there is an interesting corollary to this, and that interesting corollary has to do with all of those Thanksgiving speeches and Fourth of July speeches that we've heard about God's blessings on America and all the sort of unrelenting favors and gifts that we've gotten as America. That's just fine. It's true. You know, we ought to be grateful for all of the blessings and gifts that America has received. But it is somehow stated in such a way as to not take into account, usually, this other dimension of what would come from what Luther is saying. And that other dimension is that whenever the United States throws its weight around in the world, economically or politically, in such a way as to produce injustice, God is working against America, not in favor. Right? So we ought to factor into our thinking that we are the rich and the powerful of the world, and if God is about doing this breaking down of the rich and building up of the lowly and feeding the hungry and sending those with food away empty-handed, we have to think about where we are in that equation and more seriously than we often do. And therefore, as Christians, we have to think very, very carefully about the temptations of nationalism and the temptations of rhetoric that talks about our presumably privileged role in the United States, in the world, in a sense that not just is grateful for that, but uses that as a reason to throw one's weight around. That becomes where it becomes a problem. So a fourth of these suggestions, and this is only kind of practical advice, is that we ought to think about altering the intensity of our behavior to reflect the certainty of our information about what harms or benefits another person. As when we're quite certain that we have a clear sense of what will harm somebody else or is harming somebody, we ought to get really, really intense about our actions. But in those cases where it's complex enough so that we're not entirely sure about it, it's probably best not to go off on some big crusade for some particular proposal to solve it. I mean, we might not have the whole answer in a particular proposal. But what also is involved here is that it's probably best not to do nothing. Because giving involved at some level of intensity, even if it's not going off on a big crusade, getting involved in some level of intensity is a way of finding out more. That is, the fact that something's complex, or the fact that something's difficult, or the fact that something that we may not certain that we know the answers about it, should not prevent us from trying to find some level of participation or activity commensurate with our uncertainty, such that we can get more involved, learn more, grow more, figure out more, listen more, etc., to the point where our level of certainty can not ratchet up a notch or two, and our behavior can go along with that. A fifth suggestion is that we should expect neither too little or too much from others. That is, when we expect too much from others, it would be to expect that everybody else acts in a very ethical way. Well, we'll wind up being disappointed if we try that. But on the other hand, it's very important to acknowledge that people are capable of ethical behavior, and therefore to do whatever we can to encourage, prompt, invite ethical behavior on somebody else's part, whether that's praising them or whether it's giving more information or whatever it is that's needed to help do that, because the capacity is there. We shouldn't expect too little from other people, just as we would be disappointed if we expected too much. The last thing that I mentioned, and I want to invite you to participate in discussion, is that
For Luther, the incarnation was very, very important. The incarnation was such a special thing for him because God was fully present in Jesus, he believed, and Jesus was fully human, which meant that there was no incompatibility about the divine and the human being together, or the divine and the creaturely being together. And it was also important for him because it was such a kind of surprising place where God was so evidently present. And it was, God was present in this backwater, occupied, tiny nation over the eastern end of the Mediterranean, coming out of Galilee, which was the most disreputable part of Israel at the time because it was the most syncretistic and so on. What good can come out of Galilee? Remember that statement in the Gospels? Coming from an unwed mother, coming from a family that was relatively poor, coming from having to put up with, to identify with people that were putting up with all sorts of oppression from the Romans and so on and so on and so on. It was an odd place for God to show up. And that surprise never stopped amazing Luther. So on the one hand, it's very important that God could be present and human, full humanity could be there at the same time. On the other hand, it was interesting that it was such a surprising place. Now what I would suggest, and this is my own phrasing, that there is a kind of incarnational principle. And the incarnational principle is that the presence of God in the human Jesus was typical of God's activity. It wasn't just a terribly unusual event, it was typical. So that for Luther, for example, when he would talk about Christ's presence in the sacrament, the bread and the wine, said on one occasion, there's nothing unusual about Christ being bodily present in bread and wine. Christ is bodily present in a rope too. The only reason you don't go down to the hardware store and chew on a rope is that Christ has promised to be present in the sacrament, and we so desperately need that promise so that we have some reassurance of the presence in the midst of ordinary life. But the purpose of it is to break open our awareness so that we see the presence of God and we see the presence of Christ in all other eating and in all other actions in the world, such that we, so it's broken open to see the presence of God. And so if the incarnational principle is at work, what ethics is all about is not God standing there with some kind of a ruler saying, you must do this, forcing you to do this. Rather, God is standing out there inviting you to come along, inviting us to come along. It's like God standing with a poor person saying, psst, look over here. Listen to what's happening over here. Look for what's happening over here. And to participate with what God is already doing in the world, such that we are invited to be with God in the activity that is going on, that is revealed in Jesus, the Christ. And that gives an invitational character, a come along with character, a kind of luring from the future into some other possibility character of ethics, rather than this sort of legalistic sense that sometimes people can get into, we ourselves can get ourselves into. Okay. So my suggestion is that the incarnational principle is another part of what could be helpful in thinking about ethics and ethical implications. Well, this is just a beginning. Some suggestions, and I'd invite you to either comment on them or to add others that you'd like, a seventh, an eighth, a ninth, a tenth, an eleventh, a twelfth. I don't pretend these are exhaustive by any means.
How did you come up with these? Or where are these? Are these from Luther? Or
no. Thank you for asking that. No, these are not from Luther. That is, this one, I think, is from Luther.
Okay.
But the rest of them, well, preacherliness also, I think, could come from Luther because of a lot of emphasis on the human being a creature, the goodness of creation.
Yeah.
Christians are called to recognize the goodness of their own createdness and so on. So this one comes from Luther, this one comes from Luther, but the rest of it comes out of my head.
Okay.
Just and attempting to kind of amplify a couple of things I've been trying to say in other ways during the week. Do you want to follow up on that?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
This idea of using the God Bless America, there's been some commentary about that, but that might be actually used in God's name too. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, see, it all depends upon what one means by bless. Yesterday, Andy Rockness, in his presentation, said that in the Beatitudes, blessed should have the sense of God being with, in the sense of being active, God's active presence there. Well, in the sense of praying for God's active presence with America, there's nothing wrong with that, right? But if we assume that active presence is a confirmation of everything that we do, then that's where it becomes a problem, in my judgment. I once heard John Denver sing way back, this was Vietnam era, and he sang at the, I heard him more than once, but one time I'm thinking about it, I heard him sing at the University of Minnesota Northrop Auditorium, a benefit concert for a cheerleader who had fallen off a trampoline, missed a trampoline some kind of an exercise, and paraplegic as a result. So there was a very serious accident we were doing. And Northrop Auditorium, I don't know what it holds, but 5,000 people or something. It was packed. People were sitting in the aisles. If fire marshal had come, he would have had a heart attack. They had bleachers on the back of the stage, and there were people sitting on the back of the stage. And John Denver sang that night. He had a couple other people that came up, Mary Travers, and a couple other people from Peter Paul and Mary to sing. But the concert went for 3 hours. And I've been at other John Denver concerts, but that one, it was like the audience was just with him. It was kind of electric. I think in part because of benefit and connections and all sorts of other things. His wife at that time, I think, had connections with the University of Minnesota and so on. And at the end of it, there was all of this applause. And he came on stage and he said, normally I don't do encores because those last five songs are the message I want to leave you with. And the last five songs were, I don't remember what they were, but they were all having to do with some kind of protest against war or in favor of peace. Hey Jimmy Newman, song about the soldier who was trying to wake up his buddy who was dead and the way back to the United States. Or box with chains and locks called War. Those were at least a couple of the five. But he said, I was traveling across the United States this last summer, and a song I remembered from a long, long time ago came back to me, and I'd like to sing it for you. And he sang America the Beautiful a cappella. And in the setting, it was broken open into being a prayer, rather than a rah-rah. Remember, the times were a little bit ugly in terms of the protesters against the rah-rah patriots and so on, back and forth, and the clashes were pretty ugly. It kind of broke it open to be a prayer in a way that was kind of, that it's never left me. I kind of remember all this whole time. I don't know, am I responding to your...
Yeah, I think so. I think that the idea that defining the blessing and not saying, God, give preference to what we do,
right.
And we're late.
Right.
had a question. The, early on we started today with, what benefits neighboring community and, you have to figure out some of that stuff, like ozone is bad, that wasn't obvious at the start.
Right.
And stuff like that. So, I mean, would that lead in the, I mean, do you think, is there something in Lutheran tradition, for example, that emphasizes science and sociology and things like that? I mean, because you have to do that kind of research to find the answers to those questions.
Yes, yes. There's nothing in that tradition that's not open to science put to the benefit of the world. I mean, science can be put to others. Just like reason can be serve different masters, science can serve different masters too. In and of itself, its effects are not neutral. It's either benefiting or not benefiting the world. So yes, it's openness to that. And in point of fact, there was a big difference in the years after the Reformation, the reception of scientific investigations in the Lutheran community than there was in the Roman Catholic community, for example. With all the struggle about, Copernicus and all of that. That didn't happen. Kepler.
When was that relative to Luther? I mean, was it after?
Me out, somebody.
I don't know.
Yeah, the great scientific revolution happened after Luther was.
Yeah, but when did Copernicus live?
Oh, Copernicus.
Yeah, wasn't that in the 1400s?
Yeah,
earlier.
Which would have been just before Luther, and so the results of that would have been. But Kepler, I think, was another important person in that whole thing, and Kepler, I think, lived in Lutheran lands. In the 1500s, if I'm not mistaken. But don't take this as correct. Go look it up someplace because I could be wrong about this. But no, what I do remember is that in the Reformation lands, there was far more openness to the freedom of scientific inquiry than there were in those days in Catholic lands. Now that's not the same today, but in those days. We always have to be careful to remember the Catholic Church of today is not the same as the Catholic Church of the 1500s.
I think part of our challenge is trying to know what you are reading. Is this helping you gain your information that you're looking for? Because times you can read something and think, this is correct. And perhaps later you find this isn't. Yeah, and it's a tremendous challenge as we search to find our involvement in our community.
Right, right. And I think the only way we can bear that burden is to remember that that God takes care of God's relationship to us and our relationship to God. That's one thing we can depend upon God to do, which we can't expect God to take care of everything else, but we can't expect God to do that. And the assurance of the solidity of that relationship and the freedom that it gives to a person, is the only thing that can allow us to cope with the difficulties of finding things out or the difficulties of being wrong at first and having to have ourselves corrected and so on. And we'll all be in that situation where we act sometimes thinking that we've really understood, only to find out in sometimes quite difficult ways. I was in the session with Brad Binah this morning, and he was talking about courage being an important thing, and he was talking about his two-year-old and the way in which his two-year-old had fallen down the stairway, six stairs yesterday. And his two-year-old was now going down that part of the stairway on a seat. But he didn't stop going down the stairway. That is, there was this courage to having learned that it was harmful to do something, to pick up oneself and to do something else. And we, one of the things that is one of our liabilities as human beings is getting too discouraged when it turns out that we're in error. And so we need this encouragement from the community to keep us in there, reading again, or listening again, or coming up with a different way to try to help the problem. And I mean, all I can do is agree with you that it's difficult, but.
Well, you talked about critical thinking the other day, and isn't that, I mean, where this comes in too, because positions can be posited, you know, by very clever and persuasive reasoning.
Right.
And sometimes we have to be very careful, very thorough in our critical thinking and examination.
I'm reminded by something that Jim Wallace, what you say reminds me of something that Jim Wallace said. He wrote a book, Who Speaks for God? And in it, it's a pretty breezy book, but in it he says, one little test I have is that if somebody claims to speak for God and is benefiting by what they recommend, I'm not so sure that it is, okay? So one of the facets of critical thinking we have to be very careful for is to look for what sort of interest the author or the spokesperson might have in the outcome of this. And that's one little piece of the critical thinking. Yes, good. There's more to it than that, but that's at least one little piece of it. And then weighing and testing the use of evidence, for example. I mean, we've had this really painful year and a half, from my point of view, with regard to public rhetoric in Minnesota. Because people stand up and say, and it all has to do with state budget, and somebody stands up and say, you know, the next budget includes a 7% increase in the state, and never tell you that it's a two-year budget. So a 7% increase is 3% per year rather than 7% per year. Well, what's being left out here for the sake of the political argument, you know? It's been painful for me, not because, that there's not room for disagreement, but all the kind of camouflaging that's gone on in the rhetoric. I'm going to be going off to be partisan now, so just bear, you know, just give me some slack here, okay? I can't avoid being partisan, but when someone stands up and says, no new taxes at the state level, I was perfectly happy to have new taxes occur at the local level. I'm saying that's not being completely candid, right? There's some deception going on there at some level. So that kind of rhetoric, one has to not, you know, one has to dig behind it to see what the whole story is, because there's a selective use of data that's often employed. Others. I think that another reality we have to counter that I find in college students. I find two things in college students. One is that college students tend to say, I've got my own opinion about this. Everybody's got a different opinion about it. You got your opinion about it. It's no use talking about it. And that kind of, what I would call relativism, really undercuts our capacity to benefit from each other to find out what's ethically correct.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend a lot of time opposing that point of view. The second thing that I find among college students is a fear of talking about controversial topics. Because of a fear of a reaction that would be either emotionally damaging, harmful, risky, or even physically harmful. So responding to this one year, several years ago, I had students in a class that I was teaching do some reading about abortion and then divide up into groups of four where there was somebody on each side of the spectrum in each group of four, and then had them talk for 2 hours together, minimum. They could talk for more if they wanted to, but at least 2 hours. And at the end to write and to try to seek what they could agree about. At the end, each person submitted a paper, I mean a couple pages. These are the things we agreed upon, and listed whatever they could agree upon. These are the things that we could not agree upon that I wished we could have agreed upon. So some statements about what the person wanted that others didn't agree with. And then thirdly, an assessment of the process. And I was really quite blown away by the response. The response was A, surprise in virtually every case of how much they could agree about, because they expected this to be a battle. It turned out to be a civil conversation. And secondly, amazement that a civil conversation could take place about something. And it seems to me that one of the roles of the church in our society is to make space for conversation about controversial topics, ethical controversial topics, in a society which is lurching its way towards incivility and danger in many, many, many different ways. I remember back in the Vietnam era, in this little church that I mentioned yesterday to those of you who were here, having a conversation around a table about selective conscientious objection in the midst of the Vietnam War. And there was a member of SDS there from the University of Students for Democratic Society, a member of the most radical opponents on the college campuses of the day. There were, people that were Afro-Americans that were there. There were people, public housing projects that were there. And sitting next to me was a white-haired Republican banker from Wayzata with two sons in Vietnam. And at the end of the conversation, he turned to me and he said, "I really need to be here, because there's no place else where I hear or can experience or participate in a conversation like this." And I thought, I was glad it was happening in a church. And that's an appropriate thing for a church to do, it seems to me, is to be the safe place in which that kind of conversation can occur. Other comments or reactions?
Yeah. Just sharing your thoughts about the one voice of Luther's. Is there a one voice of Luther's, or should there be a one voice for Luther's?
Oh.
From the standpoint of positions.
With standpoint of ethical positions, are you thinking about? Yeah. No, I don't think so. I think that there might be some things on which we can have one voice, because they're so clearly rooted in the tradition. But there are many other things on which it's neither possible nor desirable to have one voice, it seems to me. If it were possible, for example, for everybody in a state legislature to be committed to justice for the poor, the oppressed, the working poor, etc., it would be very helpful to have debate between different ways to accomplish that. And it would be perfectly helpful to have Lutherans on both sides of that debate within the framework of a kind of common commitment to helping the poor. Now, what I don't think the Christian tradition or the Lutheran tradition can tolerate in the sense of approving, I'm bashing anybody's heads or anything, but tolerate in the sense of saying we approve of this, would be indifference to that question. Or the kind of thing that says what's mine is mine.
Yeah.
There was just an awful, pardon me, letter to the editor in Minneapolis Tribune this spring, in which the person talked about, you know, my money going for taxes without any recognition of all of the contributions that that person got from others in order to get his salary. Not a single acknowledgement that he drove on roads that were done at public expense. Not a single acknowledgement that he'd been given an education for which he didn't pay. Not a single acknowledgement that he was enjoying trees that somebody else had planted. Not a single acknowledgement of anything outside of himself. And I think, you know, that's really, that's outside the boundaries of what we're talking about. But within the boundaries, there's lots of room for disagreement and healthy debate and discussion, and we don't have to be uniform. In fact, our diversity can be an enrichment of seeing things from different angles and different perspectives. And we can, you know, we can say, you know, you really, really care about the environment. I want to support you and you really, really caring about the environment. I'm going to put my effort into caring about the hungry and honor each other and have different priorities. And that's part of the healthy diversity of a community, that I'll do whatever I can to support your concern for the environment, and I'll recycle and I'll do everything else, but I may not be doing everything you're doing. And meanwhile, you would come back and say, I'm going to do whatever I can to help with the hungry, but I'm not going to be doing as much as you're doing for that, you know? That kind of diversity is also just one. Am I responding, or am I missing your point?
One of the thoughts would be more powerful if the Paul Luther stand with a single voice, but I think the diversity is even more powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
That we're open for the discussion, debate, and exploration.
Just one quick anecdote about that. I was the Southwestern Minnesota Synod has an unusual procedure where they actually elect five candidates to be identified for bishop the 2nd of March this year, and the election comes the 15th of June. So during that period of time, there are five identifiable, quote, candidates or nominees, and I was one of the five. And we covenanted together, the five of us, that we all regarded this to be an exploration of calling. We were not in any kind of competition with each other, so we got together and we talked about what we should agree upon as procedures. We recommended some other venues for people to have a chance to meet people, and we added some extra sessions and did things differently. We prayed together before every forum that we were a part of, and we just did this for ourselves, but it turned out that people noticed the respect and affection that we had that developed for each other. I mean, I didn't know two or three of the people before we started, but came to know them in the process. And there were so much comment about that, you know, that the diversity of our judgments about things were said with mutual respect, and so much comment about how that was itself a witness for what could be true in terms of debate and disagreement. Barry Goldwater said in an interview that he had so much respect for John F. Kennedy, and Kennedy had so much respect for him, that had Kennedy been the nominee in 1964, they would have flown around in a plane together and debated each other in different parts of the country, and that would have been the campaign. That would have been marvelous.
Mm.
You know? It turned out that Johnson was the nominee, and those two men had no respect for each other, and the election was very different. Anyway, my point is that I think that what was recognized was that there was lots of space for diversity of different views of what the bishop could be and the synod could be, but done in such a way that it was a contribution to the whole rather than a tearing apart. That works in lots of different places. Well, I think we're out of time, so thanks so very much. If you have comments, you want to stay, fine, but our instructions are make sure you end on time.